Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
Good Sunday morning. It is not Rick Moore. It is Sean McCord. You know, Dan, I say this to you once a month. We really got to do something about that. It's not like I'm a stranger here. Good morning. It is the Sunday morning wake-up call. This is Sean McCord, your reliable monthly substitute host, while Rick gets to go off gallivanting or whatever he does on these Sundays. And my guest this morning is Joe Platania. Joe, how'd I do with your last name?
Very good.
Thank you. Joe Platania is the Assistant Commonwealth Attorney in the city of Charlottesville. Joe, you and I met, a year ago or so. And I told you then, I sort of filed away in the back of my mind, this is somebody I want to have on the show. This is somebody I want to have on local issues. Since we met, you have now announced yourself as a candidate for Commonwealth Attorney. You want to drop the assistant off your title. So we had to recognize that right up front, that you are a candidate for office. So this is my shout out to Jeff Fogle, also a candidate for Commonwealth Attorney. Jeff, if you want to come on the show, if you want to have some time here on WPVC, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville, yeah, call the station. We'll figure it out. But this is our show. You're my guest for this hour to talk about the Commonwealth Attorney Office, or I guess the Assistant Commonwealth Attorney's Office. Introduce yourself and tell us who you are and tell us a little bit what the Commonwealth Attorney Office is, because a lot of us may read about it in the newspaper but not entirely understand what it is that you do.
Sure. Well, good morning, and thank you very much for having me. So I am a candidate for the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. There is a primary this coming June 13th. I am seeking the Democratic nomination. So get out and vote on June 13th, and then the general election will be in early November. Mm-hmm. I have a campaign website, joeplatania.com, so that's the campaign piece that you referenced. The Commonwealth Attorney's Office is an office that is responsible for prosecuting all of the cases that occur, all the crimes that occur in just the city of Charlottesville. It's not a statewide office. It doesn't handle other jurisdictions or localities. If something happens in Albemarle County, they have their own prosecutor's office, the Albemarle County Commonwealth Attorney's Office, that handles it.
So in a state not in Virginia, it would probably be referred to as a district attorney.
That's absolutely right, the district attorney's office.
Right. So you are kind of the lawyers for the city.
Exactly.
So when somebody commits a crime, when someone is accused of a crime, you're indicted for a crime, they have to go to court. They'll have their own defending attorney, their own defense attorney, and you represent the city or the police department or the municipal body that is accusing that person of a crime.
Right. So Dave Chapman is the current Commonwealth attorney. He's mm-hmm. been serving for 24 years. He is stepping down after this year, and there are four assistants serving under Dave, and I'm one of those assistants, and I've been there a little over 13 years. You said some very interesting things. As prosecutors, people need to understand we don't represent the victim. We don't represent the police department. As prosecutors, we represent the community.
Good. Thank you for the clarification.
Yeah, that's a very important distinction. And I think people watch TV and, you know, sometimes think certain things. But it's important to me to make that distinction that, you know, we certainly assist victims and work very closely with them. But defense attorneys have one goal and one mission, and it's to advocate for their clients. And mm-hmm. I was a public defender for 5 years locally, so...
And I want to get back to that.
But a defense attorney has a client, and that is who they focus on, and that's whose interest they represent. Prosecutors have a very different role in the system. The other piece that's important to understand about prosecutors, and I sometimes say this in opening statements or closing statements in jury trials, and jurors always sort of, I think, give me an odd look. It is not a prosecutor's job to convict people of crime, either. That is not our job. Our job is to seek justice. That is what we're supposed to do. And sometimes that means declining prosecution of a case or dropping a case where there's not enough evidence or you think the wrong person might have been identified. So we don't represent victims. We don't represent the police. We represent the community, and our mission is to seek justice, not convictions.
That is kind of a fraught term. I should explain, because it'll probably come up, that I was a juror on a case that you were seeking justice on. And we don't have to go into the details of the case, but it was it's interesting to note that as a Commonwealth's attorney, your job, you get a lot of different cases. It's not just, as you say, it's not just what we see on TV. Seeking justice is kind of a political term. I mean, it's kind of hard not to say that and not kind of hear a drumbeat in the background, mainly, I think, because it's been co-opted by people with a political agenda. So tell us what you mean by that.
That's a great question. So I teach a clinical program at the University of Virginia School of Law, and it's called the Prosecution Clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And the clinic has 30 law students that are third-year students that are about to graduate, and they have a practice certificate, and they go to 19 or 20 different state and federal offices throughout Central Virginia, and they're able to go into court and, under the supervision of an attorney, prosecute cases and work with victims and the police. So early on in that clinical program, it's a year-long program, I sort of ask how many students want to prosecute, and then I ask them why they want to prosecute, and the answers are always varied and interesting. But I, you know, the students that say, I want to prosecute because I want to put bad people in prison,
mm-hmm.
I caution them that that might not really be the field for them, that it's really, if your mindset about wanting to prosecute is so that you can lock up bad people, that always causes me a little bit of concern. So going back to your question about what's the definition of justice or what does that mean, you can't teach that. There's not a class on it. There's not a book you can read. It's sort of it's a concept that's formed, I think, by life experiences and relationships with other people and things you've done and seen. And there's no right answer or right definition of justice. It's sort of varied. And as prosecutors, you bring different, you know, thoughts and philosophies and biases into the courtroom. What I say, and what to me forms my definition of justice, is you need to lead as a prosecutor with humility. I think when you do this job and you're seeking justice and you're seeking fair treatment of people charged with crimes and you're seeking to represent the rights and interests of victims who have been through a horrible incident, you need to start your process and analysis with a dose of humility, that you don't know everything and you don't always get it right. And then I think a curiosity to try and, you know, consider all sides. When I was a public defender, the prosecutors I most respected would listen to what I had to say and would consider information about my client charged with a crime that they might not have known. So that, to me, is sort of, you know, how you have to approach what's just. And there's no right answer. And it's, you know, I think you have to wake up every day mindful of the power that you have when you exercise your discretion. And it's really fascinating, interesting, and humbling work.
Most of us, what we know of the court system is what we see on TV, as you said. So we'll see a kind of a frothing prosecutor who's trying an important case. You know, someone's been assaulted or someone's been killed, and they're seeking justice for the victim. And seeking justice is shorthand for, you know, throwing somebody down a deep, dark hole and never seeing them again. But you're saying it's more nuanced than that. And I can attest to that, again, without getting into the specifics, but the case that I was a juror on, your approach seemed to be very, I don't know, humane. So even as you're representing the community, you have to advocate for victims of the crimes. It sounds like you're very mindful of the person who's on trial. And so what justice doesn't necessarily mean throwing somebody away and locking the key, or fining somebody, or whatever the scale of the punishment is, but trying to balance that scale.
Well, trying criminal cases both as a public defender and as a prosecutor for almost 20 years, I have come to the point, after many years and many sort of hiccups and failures along the way, I have come to the place where the most effective trial lawyers are those that can get in front of 12 members of the community that are jurors and tell a story and tell it with conviction and belief and just be yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I am not suggesting that my prosecutorial philosophy and my method of communicating with jurors is the right most effective way. What I am saying is it's the most effective way for me. I had a case, and it took 3 days. It was a very emotional, difficult case. And I was very mindful that when I started that case, I said, at the end of this third day, I'm going to have to look at these 12 people and convince them that the message I'm delivering is one of justice and an appropriate response to the situation. And I tried very intentionally to build credibility over those 3 days so that when I got up during closing argument, they would see that I was thoughtful, that I wasn't someone that was just yelling and screaming and banging on the table and, you know, talking horribly about a defendant and what they had done. I tried to be measured and credible and trustworthy. And so that's what works for me because that's who I am.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain prosecutors that would hear this and say, no, you actually really need to go in and you need to sort of breathe fire and you really need to be aggressive and you really need to do tough cross-examinations and, you know, eviscerate your opponent. And there's some defense attorneys that defend cases that way. So I just know what works for me, and, you know, that's the best I can do. And, you know, don't always succeed, but at the end of the day and at the end of the case, I sort of want to be able to have the jury say, whether we agreed or disagreed with Joe and the way he tried his case, we trust him and we respected the way he did his job. And I've lost plenty of cases. It's
sure.
It's not about that. So that's sort of the way I would sort of approach my style in the courtroom.
This is Sean McCord on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC. My guest this morning is Joe Platania, the Assistant Commonwealth Attorney for the City of Charlottesville. So, Joe, let's, now that we've heard a bit of your philosophy, let's peel back a little bit, and I'd like to learn a little bit more about you. Where do you come from? Where did you grow up? Where did you go to law school? What brought you to Charlottesville in the first place?
So I grew up in Rochester, New York, which is in Western New York. I went to Providence College, which is in Rhode Island. When I graduated in 1994, I was accepted into law school, Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But I deferred my acceptance for a year so I could participate in a volunteer program called the Jesuit Volunteer Corps. And Providence College was a Catholic college. And the Jesuit Volunteer Corps was a volunteer opportunity that I had learned about and very much wanted to do a year of service before starting law school. So I went to Houston, Texas, and taught physical education and coached at an inner city school there, Our Lady of Guadalupe.
So nothing to do with your budding law career?
No, nothing to do with that at all. I went to go teach at an inner city school and, you know, phys ed and then mm-hmm. coach some different sports. And it was an unbelievable year. I sort of always say that I learned far more from the students. It was 100% Mexican population, very impoverished area. The Jesuit Volunteer Corps placed volunteers in jobs and in areas where there was a need, but they didn't have the funding to pay. So we were a volunteer. There were three of us that taught at Our Lady of Guadalupe, and they needed teachers, but they didn't have the money to pay them.
Yeah.
So I learned far more from the kids than I taught them, I'm sure. But it sort of formed in me a belief that whatever I did with my life, that I wanted to have service be a part of it. And there are sort of four tenets of the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, but one is social justice. And so that sort of was very formative, a very formative experience, and had a great time. So did that for a year, and then I started law school, and I had no idea what kind of law I wanted to practice. You know, I don't have one of those stories of I went to law school because I just sort of went. My second and third year of law school, I got involved in a clinical program, the Virginia Capital Case Clearinghouse. And it was a clinical program where we were supervised by a criminal law professor, and we worked with lawyers that were defending people charged with capital murder. So that's the death penalty.
Yeah.
So I just fell in love with criminal defense work. And my second and third year, we did a lot of work with death row inmates. Again, a fascinating, interesting works. Concepts of social justice were involved for me. And when I graduated, I took a job in Richmond, Virginia, at the Virginia Resource Center, again, doing appellate work, which is legal research and writing representing death row inmates. I had a client that was executed. I attended the execution. That, again, was a very sort of formative, powerful experience for me about the fairness or lack thereof of the death penalty. And I knew that I wanted to do trial work, and this was appellate work, and again, I wanted to be in a courtroom. So I came to Charlottesville in 1999. There was a public defender's office that was opening. I was one of the original attorneys there.
Now, I've been here for a while, so I remember that. That was the opening of the public defender's office. We didn't have one before then.
We did not. Jim Hingley, who has since retired and is a mentor of mine, Jim Hingley was in Lynchburg. He was the public defender there. And I think there was some opposition to it being open in this community, and Jim and others advocated for it. And it was open in 99, and it was Jim and six lawyers. And I was fortunate enough to be one of the hired attorneys.
So not to, pardon the pun, relitigate that, but prior to 1999, if someone brought to court, who defended them?
So there is a list of local defense attorneys that will accept court-appointed work. So the judge would just get the list and appoint one of the local attorneys that accepted court-appointed work, and they would have counsel that way.
Mm-hmm. So what was the advantage? Again, it exists now, so I don't want to bring up old things, but just to kind of give us some perspective, what's the advantage of having a permanent public defender's office?
Well, I don't want to get into this too much, because many of the current private attorneys that accept court-appointed work are excellent attorneys, and they take retained work and private work. But the theory behind public defender's offices is that you have attorneys that are specialized and trained and do nothing but defense work, whereas someone might do real estate and some criminal defense. And so I think others would say the theory is having specialized, trained attorneys that do nothing but defense work is sort of a more effective model.
Okay, I want to get back to the transition in a moment. But so you came here originally for the public defender's office, but after a few years, you picked up and moved to the other side of the aisle.
Right. So I never wanted to be a prosecutor. Mm-hmm. It was not anything I ever thought I would do. And when I came to Charlottesville, and I loved defending my clients, I was very close with them. I thought it was meaningful work, and I just very much enjoyed that. But locally, I saw some prosecutors that sort of were able to shape and form results by reducing charges, entering into a plea agreement, making a certain recommendation to a judge. And it was a very collaborative approach, and I saw the voice of the prosecutor as one that could be very effective in helping my clients charged with crime. And there were several local prosecutors that I just tremendously admired and respected, and I said, I think I might be able to help indigent folks charged with the crime more effectively if I'm a prosecutor. And it was a thought that sort of developed over years, and there was an opening in the Charlottesville Commonwealth Attorney's Office, and I decided to apply.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a little over 13 years ago, and I've been there. And I love the work, but what drew me to it was helping people charged with crime. The other interesting thing is once I started prosecuting, I learned very quickly that I was missing a whole half of the equation, that these people that were charged with crime, often attached to those crimes, they were crime victims. Someone that had their home broken into, someone that had been assaulted, someone that had something stolen from their business. So I learned very quickly, wow, there's this whole other side that a prosecutor has to consider, not only those charged with crime and the fair treatment of them, but you've got the community, you've got victims, you've got witnesses, you've got police officers that have worked very hard to build cases, and they're interested in the result. And so the prosecutor really, to me, has to hold in both hands at the same time the safety of the community and the fair treatment of those charged with the crime. And it's just, and again, interesting, fascinating work. I really enjoy doing it.
This is Sean McCord. My guest is Joe Platania. You're listening to The Wake Up Call, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. This is John McCord. My guest, Joe Platania, the Assistant Commonwealth Attorney for the City of Charlottesville. Joe, you answered one of my questions that I was going to ask. You volunteered it, but I want to dig in just a little bit deeper, and that is how you go from being a defense attorney to prosecuting attorney. What you said, if I can synthesize it, was that you found that as a Commonwealth attorney, there were opportunities for you to shape what happens to a defendant in a way that might not have been available to you as a defense attorney. So many years ago, before I had kids, before I figured out what I wanted to do when I grew up, become a monthly radio host, I toyed around with the law. I took the LSATs. I went up and spoke to the dean at the law school. And it was very clear to me that I would want to defend people, just because that's kind of who I am by nature. So talk about the transformation you had to do in your mind from defending people to prosecuting people, but still looking for ways to see that justice is done, but by fashioning how the trial goes. I'm having trouble wording this. I mean, in a way, you're prosecuting people, but if I understand you correctly, you're also looking for ways to aid, I don't want to say aid the defendants, but make a fair trial.
Well, here's a way for people to think about it that I think everyone can relate to. I have an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old. So mm-hmm. Many people have kids. Kids will do things and test limits and make mistakes and do things that they shouldn't. And as parents, we love our kids and we care about them, but we understand that the child needs and wants a limit.
Yeah.
And there have to be consequences when they do certain things. So if you extrapolate that out a little bit, people that are committing certain types of crimes, they understand, and the community understands and expects, there has to be a consequence and a response.
Right.
We don't want a lawless society where people can go do anything they want and there's never any consequence or limit or repercussion. The gray area that prosecutors can operate in, sometimes to the benefit of someone charged with a crime and sometimes to the detriment of a person charged with the crime, the gray area and where discretion and judgment and fairness and justice come in is, what's the consequence? What's the response? If someone sells $20 worth of crack cocaine, do they need to go to prison for 10 or 20 years? My answer is absolutely not. If someone steals a $200 cell phone, and in Virginia, the limit for a felony grand larceny is $200, which is one of the lowest in the country. If someone steals a $200 cell phone and has nothing on the record, do you need to make them a felon as a prosecutor? My answer is no. We need to try and make fewer people felons if they don't have them on the record. So to me, it wasn't a huge leap, because I do have a thread in me that I think almost all of us do in this community, is that people expect there to be consequences for people that do certain things. But shaping what that consequence is the job of a prosecutor. And I think that's where you get into some of this. What do you do with a person? Most of the cases we can prove. And then the prosecutor has to sort out, okay, I can prove it, I can get a conviction, but do I need a felony? Do I need jail? Do I need prison? Is this person an addict that needs substance abuse treatment? Are they suffering from mental illness and they need to get linked up with a clinician and get stable housing and get back on their medications? These are all questions that I think when a case comes onto my desk, I try and ask myself to try and figure out what a fair result would be.
So, again, I'm going to lean back on most of us, fortunately, knock on wood, we don't have this kind of experience with the justice system. We see what we see on TV, and what we see on the news or read about in the newspaper, and those are almost always the exceptions. What we hear about or see, some, well, for example, somebody who's running for office. So they want to be seen as tough on crime. So they, you know, they come out with these drastic charges against people to show how tough on crime they are, and they kind of skirt the line of abusing their office. Have you been accused of abusing your office by not being tough enough or not representing victims well enough? Have you had to wrestle with that, or at least defend yourself against those kind of charges?
Well, I'm sure there's people out there that have complaints about me, so I can't think of a specific instance, but I'm sure there are people that have, you know, wished I was a little bit tougher. But again, to me, I've learned this over a course of years. To me, as a prosecutor, I have to be okay with the result that I'm going to reach in a case. So if I do something because I want to make a police officer happy, or I'm doing something because a victim wants this to happen when it's not really reasonable or fair, I personally have to be okay with saying to that officer or that victim or whoever it is, look, I hear you. I understand you are not in agreement with what I'm doing, but this is my job, and this is how I see the case needing to land in a fair and just place. And so, yeah, you have to be able to do that and have mm-hmm. some tough conversations with people. It doesn't happen often because I try and take the time to sit down and communicate with people and explain things to them and develop enough of a relationship of trust and collegiality and collaboration that they might not agree with it, but hopefully they can understand why I'm doing it. I've hopefully taken the time to explain my thought process and why I'm doing it. One quick thing about the tough on crime sort of platform. I might not have this completely accurate, but I think crime rates peaked in 91, and there's been a decline in crime for, you know, what's that? Geez, 25 or so years. Mm-hmm. So crime rates now, and there might have been a blip over the last year or two upwards.
They occasionally go up.
Yeah. I'm speaking in generalities,
right.
But crime rates are at the lowest that they've been in, you know, almost 30 years. And so what's exciting about that is we're right at the edge of being able to do some really amazing reforms to the criminal justice system. And so, you know, I think there's people that, you know, want to run on tough on crime, lock everyone up platforms. I see Charlottesville as this really special, unique community that has a group of citizens that are informed and interested, and they want to hear their prosecutors talk about what we're going to do to decarcerate, what we're going to do to make less people felons, what we're going to do, you know, to address the relationships of police officers with the citizens. And so I'm really excited about some of the opportunities that are being presented. Again, you have to always be mindful of community safety, and, you know, you have to keep that at the forefront. But we're at a time right now where, you know, we can do some really great innovative things.
Decarcerate is a word I was not previously familiar with. My guest, expanding my command of the English language, is Joe Platania. This is Sean McCord. We're on the Sunday morning wake-up call. I'm glad you brought up Charlottesville, because that was one of my questions. This does seem to be kind of a special town. You know, we don't have, I mean, we have our problems, but we, most of us are protected from that. You know, we're pretty secure for a town our size. You know, we're not a small town. We're kind of a small city. For a town our size, unlike places I've lived before, I lived in Los Angeles, I lived in New York, where you're sort of confronted with the edges of society every day. We're pretty safe here. Or am I speaking from a point of privilege? You have to deal with this every day. What's going on in this town? What can be improved in this community?
Well, one of the things, I do a lot of violent crime prosecutions, and one of the things I've seen, and I don't have the number, so I'm not sure if it's anecdotal, but I've heard our circuit court judge comment on it. The prevalence of firearms in the hands of young people who are taking them out during disputes and discharging them is really concerning to me. And I don't know if that's something that's been happening more recently, but it feels to me like there's more young people with guns that are being discharged and people are getting shot and killed.
Oof.
And, you know, it's a, if I could answer that question, boy, you know, it'd be amazing, and I can't. But I think it's a very difficult problem to prosecute your way out of. Mm. I mean, we can only do what we can do. I mean, the criminal justice system in some ways is a blunt instrument. It's not a scalpel. We can sort of prosecute, and then we've got sort of limited options. And we've got some good ones that we could do a better job of using. But to me, as I've, you know, been on this campaign and talked to people and learned an awful lot, I keep coming back to two words, community and relationships. And if we can get out into the community and have relationships with police officers doing community policing, prosecutors doing some community prosecuting, I can talk about that in a little bit more detail if you like. And also, I am a big believer in mentors that have legitimacy in these communities that can go out and talk to people. I get phone calls from people that are older, and by older I mean, you know, in their 40s, 50s, 60s, that were involved in the criminal justice system when they were much younger. And I say to them, I say, I need your help. I need you to get out there and talk to people. You have sort of been down this road and walked this path. You know what it's like. They'll listen to you. And so I'm a big believer in trying to develop and formalize some of those mentorships and get them out in the communities with prosecutors and police officers, because we need to get there before it happens. I mean, when four people take out guns and start shooting and someone's dead, that's, you know, we it's too late.
Yeah. So since you brought up your campaign, I think you've done a pretty good job of describing what it is that the Commonwealth's Attorney does and what your philosophy is as Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney. What changes would you like to bring to the office as Commonwealth's Attorney?
Well, one of the things that I'm very proud of that I want to continue to see utilized is our drug treatment court.
Mm-hmm.
And really is a sort of a bigger message, an emphasis on anyone who's got a substance abuse problem that's not violent, we really need to try and divert them into treatment and not jail or prison.
So define substance abuse problem as opposed to, I don't know, just someone who's, you know, busted for selling pot.
So great question. Our drug.
Really? Thank you.
Well, let's see if I give a great answer. Our drug treatment court tries to identify people that have substance abuse addictions, cocaine, heroin, meth, and they're high risk, high needs people. They need a lot of services and they have really severe problems. And so we try and divert them into drug court where they have just very intensive treatment. They see a judge every Thursday morning. And if they're successful for 12 to 18 months, they have their charge mainly dismissed, sometimes reduced.
And how's that success measured?
Is
there successful for 12 to 18 months? Successful at what?
Periods of sobriety, obtaining housing, obtaining employment, completing substance abuse classes and groups, paying your court costs and fines, and reintegrating yourself and becoming a productive member of the community. But going to your point about someone who's a recreational user, so I just had a case where a young man was pulled over and he had a small amount of cocaine in his pocket. And we had him evaluated for drug court. So they go through a substance abuse evaluation. Well, the substance abuse evaluation said, this person is not addicted to cocaine. They're not an addict. They're a recreational user of cocaine. It's still illegal and it's still a felony. But this young man was like, well, I want to do drug court to have my charge dismissed, but I'm not an addict and I don't need drug court. So there's a statute. It's called pre-conviction probation. So this man was not an addict. He was not high risk, high needs. We diverted him to another less intensive program. He still got his dismissal. And so there is a way to identify people that might not be addicted where you still can divert them out of the system from jail or prison. So that's one thing, is taking a look. Did that answer your question?
Yes.
That you don't have recreational users that you want to be putting in with addicts. In fact, there's data that shows that commingling those populations make the people that aren't addicted worse. Like, you want to keep them separate.
Sure.
The other thing that I'm very interested in that's coming is we are bringing a mental health treatment court into our community, and that is similar to drug court.
And this is new, mental health treatment court.
It is. We're in the process of obtaining funding and writing grants to bring it to our community, but it is coming, and it's the same philosophy as drug court, where you take folks that are suffering from mental illness that get charged with a crime, and sometimes that's not the ideal situation, but an officer has to do something. And you get them linked up again with clinicians and services and housing and medications. And the goal is to have the charge dismissed once you stabilize them.
So this is something that we haven't had before. And I imagine there's going to be some, on a Venn diagram, there's going to be some overlap between drug treatment court and mental health treatment court.
There is. And we try, if an individual is presenting with severe mental health issues, they're really not appropriate for our drug treatment court. That's a little bit more than the clinicians in our drug court can handle. So this will give us, as a prosecutor, again, making the community safe and treating people charged with a crime fairly. It sounds, it's a nice one-liner and it sounds easy, but it sometimes, again, it's the criminal justice system can be a blunt instrument and not a scalpel. As a prosecutor, I want as many tools in my toolbox as I can have to fix and address a problem. We're at our best locally, in my opinion, as prosecutors and as a criminal justice system. We're at our best when we're solving problems, not when we're arresting and incarcerating. That's not us at our best. Us at our best is being problem solvers. And there's a long history in Charlottesville of all the different stakeholders getting together in a room and collaborating: judges, probation officers, defense attorneys, police officers, prosecutors, mental health workers, substance abuse clinicians, community members. That's when we're at our best, is when we're together collaborating, solving problems. And everyone wins. That's win-win for everybody.
So what's our most common problem in Charlottesville? You kind of touched on what you consider the most serious problem, which is, you know, it's kind of the free flow of guns around. But sitting in the Commonwealth's Attorney Office, what do you think is the most common problem that we might be able to address?
So I want to be careful when I answered the gun violence is what concerns me. That's just because it's what I see.
Sure.
We've got really dedicated prosecutors that handle sexual assault cases and violence against women, domestic violence. So I don't want to suggest that what I see is more important than anything else, because I just want to make clear that my colleagues that do that sort of work would probably say that's what they see, and that's very concerning to them. That's a real tough question to answer. I don't know. I think that there's problems in this community and we have to address them. But overall, I think it's a safe place. But I can't really give you like a list of one or two things or crimes.
Okay.
It's just tough.
Okay, fair enough. Because I guess as a Commonwealth attorney, you get certain kinds of cases.
Right.
Right. So those are the sort of things that you see the most. But someone else from your office sitting in that chair might have a different answer.
Right. And, you know, they, again, very dedicated people that are doing really great work to try and reduce the instances of domestic violence. And I know there's a lot of work being done by the victim witness coordinator in her office and the prosecutor on, you know, sexual assaults, and a lot of education of both men and women up at the university in our community that, you know, that's a problem that we need to address. Anyone that's harming a child is also someone that, you know, we need to be looking at. There's also a newly formed task force, the Jefferson Area Coalition to End Elder Abuse, JCEA. And there's some local attorneys. Robert Tracy, the Albemarle County Commonwealth's attorney, was one of the proponents behind forming that. Doris Geldman, who is a local attorney that practices elder law. So we were seeing these cases of elder abuse and elder fraud, and we weren't really doing a good job of getting the referrals from APS and investigating and prosecuting them. We weren't doing a good job on law enforcement side of it. And so we've now linked up in this group. We meet regularly. We share information. We're trying to coordinate with Adult Protective Services and get detectives assigned to these cases and look into them. And I became involved in that just sort of by happenstance. I had a couple of elder fraud cases that just bothered me. These guys kept going back to this woman's house and having her write checks, and she had dementia, and they kept saying, "You never paid us."
Oh, wow.
So she kept writing, and I was mortified. I was like, this goes on? And so we've now sort of targeted that. So I think we need to go where the problems are, and sometimes that's a shifting landscape.
My guest is Joel Platania. This is Sean McCord, 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord. My guest is Joel Platania, the Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney. Joe, you mentioned earlier community prosecuting. I wrote that down. What is that?
So I'm very excited. The new police chief, Chief Al Thomas, mm-hmm. one of the things, and again, I don't speak for Chief Thomas or the police department, but it's my understanding that he's going to sort of make as a focal point increasing community policing. And people have different definitions of that. But really, to me, what it boils down to is when the police respond to a neighborhood or an area or a community and a crime has been committed, there's already been some sort of wrong or tension or friction. And the police are there when everyone's sort of not at their best. To me, community policing is the police are out talking with people when there is no problem. There was just an article, I think, that the police department met with a neighborhood association, and they said, what are the problems you're seeing? Right. And I think some of the complaints involved were involving lighting, trimming back like some shrubbery mm-hmm. where it was. So things that we might not think of is the work of police officers or the criminal justice system. But that's where we need to be focusing as a police department, is go out and talk to people before there's a problem. And I think Chief Thomas would say this, ask the citizens, what would you like to see us do? What would you like to see us address? What is a problem around here, according to you, before something happens? So switching over to community prosecuting, Eric Holder, who was the attorney general under President Obama, so he ran the whole Department of Justice, which is the federal prosecutors. He was, before that, he was the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia. So he was the head federal prosecutor for the District of Columbia. And he had a pilot program that he developed there where he took a group of prosecutors. And so, you know, many prosecutors' offices have a violent crime unit, a sexual assault unit, a crimes against persons unit. Well, what he did is he took a group of prosecutors and he said, I'm going to assign each of you to a neighborhood in D.C., and you're going to get out into that neighborhood and you're going to go to community meetings and community events and you're going to get to know the people and get to know the citizens and talk to them as a prosecutor about what's going on. And they're going to be able to call you if they have questions. And you're going to develop, again, going back to that word I said before, you're going to develop a relationship with them. And I have just always thought that that was a really fascinating concept. And so I would very much like to have, if I'm elected, have the prosecutors in our office, myself included, be assigned to different neighborhoods, maybe some that have felt traditionally ignored or not have a voice or not be groups that have been listened to, and develop relationships with folks and leaders in the communities that allow them to call us and say, hey, I have a question about this, or hey, there's a problem with this, or And I think that, again, if we can on the front end address some of these things before they happen, I think that that's just win-win for everybody. So just have us be out in specific neighborhoods and know the people.
So actually identify yourself as Commonwealth's attorney. I'm the Commonwealth's attorney for your neighborhood.
Yeah, like I live over by the old Martha Jefferson Hospital. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I know all my neighbors.
Yeah.
And that's because I'm just a citizen over there. But wouldn't it be great if they were like, oh, we have a problem with speeding, or we have a problem with, you know, this house, or we know that Joe's our prosecutor. He comes to our community meetings. We've got his contact information. So again, just to try and address some of these small problems before they become big ones. And I think that we're public servants, really. At the end of the day, none of us are prosecutors for the money or the prestige, or we do it because we care about the community and it's about public service. And so to me, that's just an extension of what we're already doing.
How is the city Commonwealth Attorney's Office funded?
The city Commonwealth Attorney's Office is just a department within the city of Charlottesville's government. So we are funded through the city's budget.
Okay. So you're a line item on the city. You don't get earmarked funding from the state.
You know, I have never been part of the budgetary process. That would be Mr. Chapman. And so there may be some additional funds that come from the state, but I've not ever worked on the budget and don't know. So I can't speak.
Fair enough. I didn't want to get hung up on that. What I really wanted to lead to was, are there areas that you would personally like to see more funding? You've mentioned some programs. Like you mentioned the mental health court that's coming, but you were just talking about community prosecution, but are there existing programs right now that you're looking at and thinking we could benefit if we had a bit more resources in that area?
No, I think that we've traditionally in the city sort of made do with what we're given and are appreciative of it. One of the things that is happening, and I'm not sure where the funding came from, but I'm very excited about this. And again, I subject to Chief Thomas correcting me, I believe that the department all now have body-worn cameras, and I believe this summer they're going to link them up with fleet cameras, which means that each car will also have like a dash cam that is recording things, and I think that's just better for everybody, the police and the citizens, where they're just recording instances, so we don't have to sort of do a he said, she said. And I think the police officers feel very comfortable and confident that whatever interaction is happening, that it's being recorded because they're going to conduct themselves professionally and politely. So I think there's some funding that came through for that, and I'm excited about that, but that's more the police department than the prosecutor's office.
Okay. It's going to be a tricky question, so I apologize in advance. Because you're in the Commonwealth's Attorney Office and these are people that you work for and work with, but I know there is a general concern about inequity in prosecution. There was during the height of the crack cocaine epidemic, which, as we've discussed, crime rates overall have gone down since the early 90s. But there was a feeling that if you were caught with crack cocaine, as opposed to being caught with just cocaine, powdered cocaine, that the prosecutor was going to come down harder on you. Have you seen inequities in the justice system here? I've got the census data. Charlottesville is, according to the census data, I have 77% white, 30% African American, 17% Latino American. Do you see an inequity of the people who end up before you as a prosecutor?
So to me, the first step in answering that question is to acknowledge that we do have problems within our criminal justice system related to that issue, race and poverty and socioeconomic status. So the first thing I think is that's useful is to acknowledge that there is a problem. Then the second piece of that is, okay, so what are you doing about it?
Yes.
Now, one thing is there's a great book. It's called Locked In, and it's by John Pfaff, P-F-A-F-F. He's a law professor at Fordham University, I believe. And he makes the point that there isn't really one criminal justice system. There is federally. I mean, it's the federal system is applicable through all 50 states. But there's something like over 3,000 individual criminal justice systems throughout the country. So each city or town or county has its own prosecutor that heads it. And the book makes the point that the problem with the criminal justice system is the prosecutors. He said, if you want to fix some of these problems with the criminal justice system, you need to get good prosecutors.
So your job.
Well, that's why I'm running, is I want to be part of the solution to this. Mm-hmm. And yes, my job. So I'll answer your question about what we're doing in the city of Charlottesville. There was a study that was just completed on disproportionate minority contact in the juvenile system.
Yes.
And our office was very much a participant and an advocate for that study being conducted, along with many other stakeholders in the community. So we were advocating for this study to be done and cooperating with it. It showed that there was disproportionate minority contact in the juvenile system. It didn't really reach a conclusion as to why. So that's disproportionate contact. And I don't want to get too much in the weeds with this, but then there's a word that's disparity. So there's disproportionate contact, but what you don't want to see is disparity. So when a white child and an African American child hit the criminal justice system, is there disparity in the way they're treated? And the study found that there was not disparity of treatment once they hit the system.
Okay.
So that's important, but it doesn't address the front end problem of disproportionate minority contact.
Right.
And I don't have a good answer to that. We're also currently undergoing a DMC, disproportionate minority contact study of the adult system. And Neil Goodlow, the criminal justice planner, is amassing data and studying that. I think he has like a $125,000 grant. Again, I am very supportive of that. We need to be looking at it. We need to be collecting data and sharing it and turning it over to look at the adult system. And that's underway right now. And we need to look at it and we need to try and figure out how to address it and fix it.
So disproportionate minority contact, if I'm understanding the term correctly. So for example, in a classroom, if a black child acts up, and if a white child acts up, the black child is and I don't mean to put words in your mouth, is may more likely be seen as troublesome, and something has to be done, and authorities have to be contacted.
Well, that to me would be disparity of treatment, because it's two people. Okay. That's two people doing the same thing and one being treated differently, and that's absolutely inexcusable and shouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But if you, I think a better way to phrase it might be, if you know, what did you say were the breakdown of the population for?
77% white, 30% African American, 17% Latino American, which surprised me.
So if you have 17% Latino or 30% African American, but the number of folks charged in the system are 50%, not 30%, right, or 30%, not 17%, that's disproportionate contact. They're being represented in the criminal justice system as charged defendants in a way that is not proportionate to the numbers that they make up in the population. So there's disproportionate contact. They're being pulled into the criminal justice system in greater numbers. But if you have disparity, people doing the same thing and being treated differently, which we didn't see in the juvenile study, that's a problem. So it's a little bit nuanced, but at the end of the day, it's an issue. We need to look at it. We are looking at it. And if I'm elected, we're going to continue to look at it.
So I want to go back to this community prosecution, touch on it a little bit. And how it relates to race. I'm white. I'm a white middle class homeowner in Charlottesville. I almost never have any contact with the justice system. As I said, we met because I was on jury duty. I've never had to. Well, I have had teenage children, so I shouldn't say I've never had any. I have had the police visit my house, but they were always unfailingly polite, and we worked things out. There is a uniformed police officer who lives down the street from me, and I often see his squad car parked there when he comes home for lunch. So I feel very safe, and I feel very comfortable, and I feel secure that if I have an encounter with a police officer, it'll be polite, even deferential on both sides. So for me, and for many of my peers, our experience with the court system is kind of like our experience with the health system. You don't, until you're drawn into it, we don't really have any experience. But if somebody, I had a friend of mine a few years ago got cancer, and suddenly he learned all about the health system in ways that we just weren't prepared for before. Similarly, I imagine a lot of people, if your encounter with the justice system is the police officer who lives down the street, or we occasionally call into jury duty, and suddenly you're in the middle of a crime, whether you were the victim of a crime or you suddenly find yourself a defendant. So how as a Commonwealth's attorney, what advice would you give to people? How would you prepare people who might suddenly find themselves drawn into the justice system? Is there a crash course? Are there things that you should know or knowledge that you should have at your fingertips? So should you suddenly find yourself in a situation where you're in court and you're just in foreign territory?
Yeah. One thing you said that this isn't quite answering the question, but I think people that look certain ways and might not be white males or white females, or might mm-hmm. not live in a certain part of town or have a certain socioeconomic status, do experience police officers, prosecutors, and the criminal justice system in different ways.
Yes.
So I want to acknowledge that, and it bothers me. I feel really proud and privileged to work with the men and women of the Charlottesville Police Department. I think they're very good people that care about their jobs and care about the community. So to me, to address some of these inequities, it's really as simple as one encounter at a time, and treating someone with respect one encounter at a time. And that goes for someone who's interacting with a police officer. They've got a family, they've got children, they've got lives, they want to go home. So treat them with respect. And I think the police need to also do that. And there's a culture that you can develop that I hope we have here that's set by Chief Thomas. And I think it applies to prosecutors, judges, probation officers. I found that if you treat people with dignity and respect, and the advice I would give to people that are caught up in the system is, you know, try and treat the clerks with respect. Try and treat, you know, your defense attorney with respect. I think if we're all, and this sounds kind of hokey, but if we all just sort of, you know, treat each other like we'd like to be treated, things will probably work out okay. And that applies to all of us.
Sure. But if you are, a minority in this town, if you feel like the justice system is already stacked up against you, if you feel like you're not, that you're already not being treated with respect, when you've spoken to defendants before, do you have like tools at your hand to kind of diffuse those situations?
Yeah, I think the first thing I say is the problem that you're expressing about not having a history of being treated fairly, that's not your problem, that's mine as a prosecutor. Like, you don't need to do anything to fix it, I do. And I think when you start from that position of humility and curiosity of what can I do better, people are very responsive to that. And if you look them in the eye and say, look, I care about you and I want to do better and the police want to do better and we want to do better as a system, if you'll just give us a shot to do that and to try one relationship at a time to make this better, people are very receptive to that. But I tell them it's not your problem. You've done nothing. It's ours. And I don't know if a lot of prosecutors want to talk that way, but again, I've learned as I'm going through this campaign and being a prosecutor, you have to just be true to your core. And if you're true to your core, it's going to work out just fine, because that's what people want. Whether they agree or disagree with you, they just want to hear what's at your core and be honest with them and shoot straight with them.
All right, Joe, we have just a little less than a minute left, so I'm going to let you mount up on your soapbox. Your first 100 days as Commonwealth Attorney. Since that seems to be in the zeitgeist these days. What would you like to accomplish?
Oh, geez. Someone told me, I think it was Chief Thomas, I was talking to him. He said the first 6 months of the job, he said, your head's going to be spinning. So I'd like to probably just get through it. But if I'm fortunate enough to be elected, I think we can do really great things in this community.
So a year from now. What changes, what benefits does this town have from Jill Patania as Commonwealth Attorney?
I'd like to see strengthened relationships with community members. I'd like to see a mental health treatment court. I'd like to see, community policing up and running, community prosecuting up and running. I'd like people to say that's an office that I can call and get access to people and get my questions answered and be treated with fairness, respect, dignity. They're doing a good job, the community's safe, and if you get charged with a crime in the city of Charlottesville, know that you're going to be treated fairly and with respect.
Perfect. Thank you, Joe. My guest, Joe Platania, the Assistant Commonwealth Attorney for the city of Charlottesville. This is Sean McCord. It's always a pleasure to be your host here on the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Thank you, Dan, for all that you do behind the scenes. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake-Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.